Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Between 1854 and 1930, it's estimated that between 200 and 250,000 children were involuntarily put on orphan trains and placed out in the southern and western United States. Both protections for the health and safety of these children and record keeping of who they were and where they went and accounts of what happened to them are sketchy at best. William Deloes van Steenburgh was one of the last of the placed out children on an orphan train. At age 4, he and his slightly older brother were placed out from Pennsylvania after their mother died in 1930. William had clear memories of being loved and treated well until then. After a long train ride, he was removed from a station platform in Gallup, New Mexico, by Henry and Eleanor Walters. They gave him their last name, repeatedly abused him and treated him in the most wretched manner for 5 years. He successfully ran away at age 9 and then was free to create a unique adventure and life for himself until he died in Santa Rosa, California in January of 2017. Victoria Golden, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, met William Walters in 2012. Intrigued by his story and his keen memory for details, they met almost every week for the next 4 years. Golden recreated his story into his memoir, A Last Survivor of the Orphan Trains. When Victoria Golden visited the Radio Curious studios on July 24, 2018, we began when I asked her to describe the kind of person William Walters was.
Boy, I guess like anyone else, he was complex. I would say if you met him the way I did initially, what you would see and hear is a very charming person who seemed well-schooled and curious about the world, a good listener as well as a good talker, a gentleman. But the longer I got to know him, the more I realized, because of his experiences and all that life had handed him, there were layers, some of them troubling. He had been hurt as a child, and there were demons. They didn't show up very often, but it was clear. He never got angry at me, but when he talked about people who had hurt his feelings or offended him in some way, he would become pretty emotional. And I know by the end of writing this book, from having talked to his kids, or one of them, that he wasn't a particularly easy father. He was loving in many ways, but he could be verbally, I would guess, abusive. I mean, he would say things that he shouldn't have, and it was like those old experiences coming forth in him. So most people wouldn't have seen that, and I realized in asking him questions, he was not a well-educated person in the traditional sense of the word.
By well-educated, formal schooling?
He had about 18 months, 24 months of formal schooling in his whole life. And he was self-educated. He was a voracious reader. So the fact that he sounded well-educated was in large part the result of his reading and his world experiences.
Victoria, tell us how you met him.
He had attended a grief group held by hospice in Santa Rosa that a very close friend of mine had attended. They had both lost their spouses. His wife of 65 years had just died. And my friend said, knowing that I'm a writer, you have got to meet this man. He told about himself in grief group, and he has quite a story. And so she set up a lunch meeting she attended, and William and his daughter attended.
And this was the beginning of the four-year episode in which you heard his stories, and as you write in tidbits on your website, it was like psychotherapy.
After a while, it became that way because his loneliness came out. The woman who had died really had been key to a successful adult life for him. She had given him love in the way he had never experienced, except maybe as a very small child when he was still with his mother, his birth mother. And this woman really eased his way in the world. And when she died, it was a terrible loss.
You mentioned that he was hurt as a child, but that was after he was put on the orphan trains.
Right. He had very positive memories of the first few years of his life. And he was four, almost 5 years old, when he was put on an orphan train. His mother had just died. And then everything changed for him. But he did have that basis, the first few years of his life, a feeling of safety and love.
When you say hurt as a child, what happened?
Well, he was physically abused and sexually abused. And the book does not spend a long time on those harsh realities. I give the reader what I think is a good idea of what happened. But he was really treated terribly by the couple who took him off that train. They were strangers. And in the way that orphan trains operated, children most times were put on station platforms at train stops or taken to the local church and offered to local people. And the idea was that these kids would get decent homes, but that often didn't happen. Sometimes it did. But the couple who took him in were really harsh and actually twisted. And so he became consumed with the idea of running away. And he tried that almost immediately. I don't want to go into the detail. I briefly become graphic in the book for just a few pages, describing the level of abuse he suffered. He knew it wasn't right because he'd had this basis. And maybe certain people have a resilience. He always thought his life would be better, that he would get away and things would improve.
And in fact, they did.
They did. I mean, he tried running away over and over, and finally he was old enough and he was large enough for his age that people didn't question him anymore. He did it successfully. He was going on 12 when he finally ran away successfully.
And around that time, there was an experience in jail.
Yeah, that was one of his. He had a lot of adventures as a runaway, and this was during the Great Depression. So times were harsh for most people. And he was in Texas, Oklahoma, sometimes New Mexico, going back and forth on freight trains and hitching rides, looking for work to feed himself and to survive, and living in hobo camps or jungles. And he was in an Oklahoma jail. Well, he was picked up for vagrancy. In those days, if you didn't have $2 in your pocket and you were stopped by the police, you were taken to jail as vagrant because they wanted to get you off their streets in these small towns. And so he was taken into this jail, and all things considered, it was a pretty good situation, he decided. He had three meals a day, which he wasn't used to having. And the jailer came upstairs and said, "I'm going to take you somewhere right now." And William thought, "Oh no, what's going to happen? Are they going to beat me or what?" Well, he took him to the library and got him a few books. So he even had reading material, and he was told, "If you read these and write book reports on them, the judge says I should take you back and get you three more books." It was a pretty decent experience. So he was released after 17 days. And he said, "Don't ask me why 17, but that was the amount of time." And he's back on the street and he's walking through the town. And the deputy picks him up again and takes him to the judge. And William says, "Judge, if you don't let me get out of town, I'll always be a vagrant in this town." And the judge says, "Look, it's cold outside and there's not much I can do for you, but this is what I can do for you. I can give you a warm, safe place to stay until the weather gets better." So this happened several times. And William was so touched. He said, "You're a good guy, Judge."
Is there a backstory as to why the judge was so favorable to William?
It could be William looked like the all-American boy. He was blonde-haired. He was a nice-looking kid. He had good manners. And he was hardworking. He probably gave off a feeling of good behavior and diligence. His ethic was to work for food and work for shelter. And I think he probably kept himself clean as well.
You write in characterizing his ability to perceive the world, an ability to detect a note of love and understanding, even when he would hear a parent having a lot of impatience in her voice, trying to round up her kids.
Yeah, he'd be walking down the road. Here he was, a lonely kid, 12, 13, 14 years old, and he was so hungry for connection and family. And so if he observed a mother reprimanding her children, he would see through to the love behind it, I guess a desire to protect your kids or just look after them. And he just craved that.
Did he ever find it?
He did. Actually, for a brief period, he was taken in by a Mormon family in Arizona and had a wonderful stay with them, but they lost their farm. And he moved on. And then, of course, when he found his wife, and I don't want to give away too much about that, she provided love and nurture and all that he'd been missing.
Related to what you are talking about, his wife, was where he lived in New York City, in the Newsboys' home.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, ironically, he didn't realize this until we worked on the book. The Newsboys' lodging or home was created by the same man who created the orphan trains, Charles Loring Brace, who was a Methodist minister. And this man's intentions were only good. He saw all these thousands of street kids on the streets of New York. And by some estimates, in 1854, when he created the Newsboys' lodging and started the orphan trains, there may have been 30,000 kids who were either street kids or in the orphanages in New York. When William found his way back to the East Coast, I would say he was by then 15 maybe. He asked a policeman if there was a place for a kid like him, and the policeman pointed him to the Newsboys' lodging, and it was a wonderful deal. It was like a hotel. It was right downtown near City Hall Park, and boys could stay there and either pay for their lodging in a way by working there in the dining room or cleaning rooms, or when they got jobs, then they would pay something to the lodging house. And it gave him a sense of stability that was invaluable, because he would have one job after another. And when he would have these temporary jobs, you know, instead of worrying about where he was going to eat next, he'd go home and the next day he'd go out and find a new job.
The Newsboys' home provided him a social group as well that I'd like you to tell us about. But first, I want to say that we're visiting with Victoria Golden, who wrote the memoir of William Walters. It's called A Last Survivor of the Orphan Trains, trains on which young children were put that took them across the country. They were paraded at train stops on the platform, and people unknown to them would adopt them. William Walters, the storyteller in A Last Survivor of the Orphan Trains, experienced that. His book, a memoir, is Victoria Golden Telling the Story of William Walters in William's Voice. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Victoria, the social group in which he became involved at the Newsboys' home. Tell us about that.
Well, there were several boys that he became friends with. He said himself that he tended to attract oddballs, and I think it was because he felt like an oddball. And whatever the reason, one of them dressed partly in the uniform of the Royal Air Force, and another was a black kid. I think there were four guys. They would go out together on nearby steps of buildings, and one of them would dance, and the others would sing, and I think one of them had a guitar. They would have a great time. This would also attract girls. This was a neighborhood right near Little Italy.
One of those girls became important in his life.
Well, he noticed her right away because she seemed to care so much about the boys at Newsboys. She would ask if they had enough food and that kind of thing. And so he sensed this sympathy in her, which he would pick up on something like that immediately. So, and he found her very attractive. I don't want to say too much more about that.
Well, let's jump ahead to World War II and his experiences there. How would you summarize those?
I would say that, first of all, he made a point of not wanting to talk about combat. He never talked about actual combat, but he described the work that he did, which was very, very dangerous. The Marine Corps, he was a Marine, and the Marine Corps in boot camp, well, after boot camp, gave him a test where they picked up on the fact that he had a fantastic memory and ability to absorb information. So they sent him off to learn Japanese, and he became fluent in 6 months. And so he was made part of a group that was sent into the Pacific Islands that were occupied by the Japanese, and he and the other guys would radio back to our battleships and bombers where the gun emplacements were, where the Japanese were set up their ammunition storage and so forth, and then the islands would be bombed and invaded.
How did he get the information about the ammunitions?
He would spy. He would go off by himself. Each man, as I understand it, was by himself in the island jungle observing the enemy. They each had a grid that was established. They would refer to their grid, and then the people on the battleship and in the bombers would have the same grid. So William might say, okay, there's a gun emplacement at A19. That's where you need to bomb. And then bombs would fall, and William would observe how effective they were, and he'd say, you need to go another 500 feet in the other direction. So there was the danger of being discovered. There was the danger of being injured. And then once our forces hit the beach and took the island, he and the other guys in his 19-man unit would fight alongside them. So, of course, there was the danger of being in battle.
I realize there are in-depth stories about William Walters that you could share with us, but time precludes some of that. Moving ahead, he had years of successful employment, working for Macy's in downtown San Francisco in Union Square.
Well, that was so unexpected. After the war, he had work as a plumber, factory worker. He learned upholstery, eventually became a public safety officer, but wasn't very good at that job. He and his wife eventually moved to Northern California from Southern California and opened a little shop in Cloverdale. The shop had, after a while, too much competition, so it went out of business. And he, as he always did, immediately looked for work. At the time, he was about 40 years old, and he saw an ad in the paper for a job at Macy's in San Francisco. He and his wife were living in Santa Rosa, and he thought, well, I can do this commute. What he didn't understand when he went to interview for the job was that it was for the head of the design department at Macy's San Francisco, and that the person hired would be in charge of 16 other employees and the designers at all the Bay Area Macy's. He got the job and was totally startled by that. And in the book, I explain how that happened. It's another tidbit that I'll save for the reader. But he had that job for 21 years. In connection with that job, was able to travel the world. The executives decided that a good promotion for Macy's to draw in customers would be to have annual design shows with themes like the rainforest, or the Amazon, or Papua New Guinea. So in advance, he would go with one or two other people, flying to those parts of the world and gathering totems, masks, pottery, various design artifacts to make a part of those shows. And he loved it. He loved travel, as it turned out. Being a kid on the road as a preteen and teen did not turn off any interest in travel for him. He loved it. So traveling the world was fantastic. And that was the beginning of him and his wife also traveling to far-flung places.
Victoria Golden, how did you put this book together after 4 years of recording William Walters' stories?
Well, I started immediately. I would type what William said to me. I'd bring my laptop. And when I'd come home from one of our weekly sessions, I would review my notes. And when someone tells you their life story, it's not usually chronological. And he would think of other things from other parts of his life he would mention while he was telling me about his childhood. I would be organizing or reorganizing all along the way, also smoothing out what he was saying to me. So I was editing as I went, and also seeing what I had neglected to ask. That's an eye-opener when you're getting someone to talk to you and later look at what you've recorded and say, why didn't I think of that? So there was that process. And then after a while, I showed it to him, what I was typing, and he would see if he wanted to add anything or correct anything. And by the end of the 4 years, I was showing it to readers and seeing how it worked for them. I had an editor, a longtime friend, look at it and offer comments in direction and what was needed further or what needed to be cut. Then a New York agent read the book and said, you need to insert perspective on this. The reader needs to understand what these different experiences mean as he's telling us about them. So then I started writing these sections that were inserted between the chapters written in William's voice. And I think of them as flash forwards and commentaries that give you a taste or an inkling of the importance of what you're about to read or what you just read.
Was this your first memoir?
I had done the story of the man who had died, who met William as a gift to him while he was dying. I had helped him record his life story for his children. And that was a much shorter project, but it did the job, and I felt like I'd given him something. And then, of course, there was a lifetime of writing. I've been a writer all of my adult life.
How did writing the memoir of William Walters affect you, Victoria Golden?
I have never been that immersed in anybody's life. I knew him better than I know my husband. I mean, who would sit for 4 years and ask their husband about every detail of his life? And of course, William had a near photographic memory and also had very startling things happen to him. It was really hard hearing about the abuse. I was living it, well, not quite, but I was experiencing it secondhand while I was trying to do justice in writing up what he told me, conveying his words. And so that was, I had never done anything like that before.
I'd like to ask more about you And to begin, can you share with us a eureka or an aha moment that changed your life?
Well, actually, it had to do with writing. As a small child, I was a very promising dancer. And my mother squelched that. Someone had recommended that I study with a former ballerina in New York City, and my mother would have nothing to do with that. And that was a major disappointment. I loved dancing. So that, and I pursued it in other ways until I was, I guess, preteen. But I was done with dancing by the time I was in high school and had grown awkward. And anyway, I'm sitting in my English class, and these kids come in from the journalism department at my high school and start talking about writing for the school paper and how much fun it is, and they're looking for people to be writers. And I thought this, it was like that light bulb moment where this light bulb lit in my head, and I thought, that would be fun. I would really like to do that. And it changed my life because I did it.
And Victoria, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I have a couple of novels that I wrote that I love, and I want to go back to at least one of them and see if I can improve it and get it published, then go on to write other fiction.
I have an economic question. Okay. Using a last survivor of the orphan trains as an example, is this an investment of time, love, and money, or is there an economic return to you?
I'm not counting on economic return, especially since the book is self-published. And my other books were published by traditional publishers. I've had two other books published, one by Simon & Schuster and one by HarperCollins. And even with those, with major distribution, the second one sold 14,000 copies, there was no way that it would support me. But so this is a labor of love. It was something I wanted to do because I love it.
Well, Victoria Golden, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Well, recently I read Educated by Tara Westover, which is a memoir and a very powerful one. She's a young woman, I think she's now in her late 20s, who grew up in a fundamentalist Mormon family in Idaho under very difficult circumstances, was supposed to be homeschooled with her brothers and sisters, and it really didn't happen. And she craved education.
Victoria Golden, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
Victoria Golden prepared the memoir of William Walters entitled A Last Survivor of the Orphan Trains. The book Victoria Golden recommends is Educated, a memoir by Tara Westover. This program was recorded on July 24th, 2018. There are over 700 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.